This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 12th, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 129. Happy Easter and happy Passover. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. The Is It Just Me commentary. Press freedoms at risk in a state of emergency. More than a billion people are in some degree of lockdown. International free press advocates assess how COVID-19 is affecting the flow of information and the state of the media. The big deal feature. The view from Bowen Island. I catch up with Jim Mullen of TSN and Football Canada. Plus, I'll award a virtual Nanaimo bar to those making a difference. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or are you concerned about the quality and quantity of reliable information on the coronavirus pandemic and the economic crisis? If you aren't, I suggest you should be. On April 8th, I observed the Global Health Crisis Reporting Forum webinar produced by the International Center for Journalists. The hour-long discussion focused on threats to media freedom associated with the coronavirus pandemic, including attacks on journalists, criminalization of journalism, increased surveillance and restrictions on access to information. Here is David Kay, the United Nations Special Rapporteur, on the promotion and protection of the right of freedom of opinion and expression.
We all recognize, and really everybody who's working in journalism and in freedom of expression recognizes that in time of a public health crisis, that there will be some potential for restrictions that we would never accept in other circumstances. And in fact, under international human rights law, which really provides for a robust freedom of expression, the right to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas of all kinds, regardless of frontiers, there's still the possibility for states to restrict that when it's provided by law and when it's necessary and proportionate to protect public health. So there is a framework for restriction, but I think what we're starting to see, or we've seen over the last several weeks, are concerns that are arising in a number of different areas, which suggest either that states are not pursuing necessary restrictions, or they're pursuing restrictions that are simply disproportionate to the nature of the threat. And I would put them, actually, they track a lot what you were suggesting before. I would mention five that are real challenges right now. One is access to information that's held by public authorities. So freedom of information laws, are those still being applied and implemented as they should be, particularly in a moment of public health crisis? To what extent are public authorities actually sharing information that is important for the confrontation of the virus? Two, what about access to the internet? There are internet shutdowns around the world, or the slowing of speeds in a place like Kashmir, for example, that are having real harms on public health. And then we can also think about that in terms of the digital divide. People in places of poverty where they don't have ready access, or minorities or women who don't have access to the internet, to what extent is that being provided to them? As you mentioned, promotion and protection of journalism. There are a number of places where we see journalism reporting on COVID-19 being essentially criminalized. People getting knocks at the door from security services, don't report on this. People being denied all sorts of access. Then there's public health disinformation, which I'm sure is a big topic that we'll want to talk about. You know, to what extent should governments be addressing disinformation out there? There are a number of criminalization approaches that are deeply problematic that we could talk about. And also there are issues around disinformation on internet platforms. And then finally, as you mentioned, surveillance. I think all of those things provide or present real challenges to us as a community and to journalists.
Joining Kay on the webinar was Courtney Ratch, the Director of Advocacy for the Committee to Protect Journalists.
I mean, basically, we have to treat the United States as we would any other country. And, you know, we always have, when there were arrests and during Occupy Wall Street, for example. We covered those. But it was really in the wake of the 2016 presidential election that saw so many, you know, threats and attacks and online harassment against the press that we decided to create a North America program. We have a U.S. correspondent, and we helped found the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker, which continues to document incidents in the United States. But here in the U.S., what we're seeing is, once again, the highly problematic and detrimental impact of anti-press rhetoric from the president and others. And the reason that this is problematic is because, you know, it sends a signal globally. It is undermining to journalists who are on the front line, literally risking their lives in some cases to bring us news. It is further denigrating the idea that there is fact or truth. And this is the time when we need journalists the most, because most of what the public is going to know about how to keep themselves safe, about combating the coronavirus, about understanding how their government is responding, is going to be coming through the media. So journalists are more important than ever. We're also tracking with deep concern the issue of access to information, freedom of information, the idea that the FBI is saying that they're no longer going to honor records requests and limiting those during the coronavirus pandemic or requiring in-person requests. You know, this is really problematic. We are preparing to launch a report looking at the Trump administration and the press, just as we did with the Obama administration, the press. That will be coming out in about a week and a half, and we'll get into more details just looking at the broad swath of that. But we are seeing this anti-press rhetoric ricochet around the world, President Bolsonaro, President Duterte, you know, kind of the usual suspects. But in this case, the pillaring of the press, as I mentioned earlier, is also leading to public disregard and public fear, which can lead to unsafe conditions for the press.
That was UN Special Rapporteur David Kaye and Committee to Protect Journalists Courtney Ratch on the April 8th webinar held by the International Center for Journalists. You can see the whole webinar. Go to icfj.org. The situation in British Columbia is not as dire as in other countries where the pandemic is more severe and or there is little or no freedom of the press. But the public on the west coast of Canada needs to know it is far from business as usual for journalists in British Columbia. What we took for granted at the start of March was gone by the end of March. Government news conferences with public officials have largely moved to teleconferences, where only one question is allowed and no follow-up is permitted. A government public relations staffer decides who gets to ask the questions and how long the call lasts. Access to the courts, city halls, government offices, and libraries is restricted. Some are even closed to the public. For citizens with low incomes who want to stay in the know, they cannot access the internet for free, again, because public libraries are closed. Reporters in BC are deemed an essential service for now under provincial law, but will that last if the Federal Emergency Act is declared? Meanwhile, the BC government convinced Information Commissioner Michael McAvoy on March 18th to make a blanket order allowing all public bodies in the province, including the Health Ministry, to delay disclosures under the Freedom of Information Law to June or July. McAvoy has refused to act on complaints from the Breaker.News that the Health Ministry is ignoring the public interest override section of the law, which requires immediate disclosure of records if they're about a risk to public health. Meanwhile, some mainstream media outlets, big and small, are suffering a loss of advertising revenue and laying off staff. It is no easier for an independent. Here at the Breaker.News, please consider donating on Patreon and tell two friends to tell two friends too. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. James Oten in ABC News Australia. As coronavirus cases escalate in India, Australians pool their cash to arrange charter flights home. About 1,300 Australians in India asked the government for help to get out. Many say India's sudden coronavirus lockdown left them stranded. The first flight out of India to Australia was on April 11th. Tickets were likely to cost about $2,000, which is more than half what Australians paid for official emergency flights from Peru. Organizers expect up to 10 flights can be scheduled from Delhi, Mumbai, and Chennai, but are concerned about how long this may take, as authorities have requested each flight is staggered by 3 days to cope with the influx. Kenneth Yao in the South China Morning Post, coronavirus, Hong Kong food shortage risk after mainland China tightens border virus checks. Drivers without a health certificate from a hospital saying they have not tested positive for the coronavirus in the previous 2 weeks will be refused entry at the border. The new health measures announced by Shenzhen authorities came as a shock for many of Hong Kong's cross-border truckers who would need to get a health certificate before the rules come in. According to the Census and Statistics Department, mainland China is the largest origin of Hong Kong's imports. In 2018, imports from the mainland accounted for 46.3% of the value of Hong Kong's total, at the equivalent of $392 billion Canadian dollars. In the Japan Times, small cinemas in Kansai turn to T-shirts as they struggle in pandemic. In a single day, the theaters received orders for some 2,700 T-shirts, which have the phrase, "Save Our Local Cinemas," printed on the front, about nine times their daily target. The project was launched jointly by 13 small cinemas in and around Osaka and the nearby cities of Kyoto and Kobe. The number of visitors to the cinema has kept falling, despite the efforts to continue showing movies while taking infection control measures such as frequently ventilating the theater and asking customers to sit at a distance from one another in the theater. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Wuhan Coronavirus Pandemic 2020. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. Czech News, GoFundMe, Victoria Petting Zoo hoping for help amid COVID-19. Less than a week after the Beacon Hill Children's Farm Petting Zoo opened, as it usually does in March, it closed right back up because of COVID-19. The small farm opened 35 years ago and is home to alpacas, chickens, ducks, pigs, and of course the goats, who right now are giving birth. With no money coming in, they raised more than $6,000 in a GoFundMe appeal to keep it going for another month, but will need $72,000 to reopen next spring. In the Seattle Times, Capitol Hill Block Party cancels 2020 festival due to coronavirus, foreshadowing quiet summer. Organizers plan to resume the long-running music fest that attracts around 10,000 fans per day, July 23rd to 25th, 2021. Capitol Hill Block Party joins Northwest Folklife Festival and Thing in Port Townsend as the latest local fests to be postponed or canceled. In Vancouver, BC, the Jazz Festival, Bard on the Beach, and BC Super Week cycling races were all canceled last week. The Catalano Street Party on West 4th Avenue in Vancouver remains scheduled for July 11th. And Lizzie Acker in the Oregonian, 13 corny grandpa jokes to help you feel better about the coronavirus pandemic. If your grandpa isn't around anymore or is bad at email, you might have missed these cheesy jokes. I'll give you just the best four of these, the best four according to me. Half of us are going to come out of this quarantine as amazing cooks. The other half will come out with a drinking problem. I used to spin the toilet paper like I was on Wheel of Fortune. Now I turn it like I'm cracking a safe. I need to practice social distancing from the refrigerator. And last one. I don't think anyone expected that when we change the clocks, we go from standard time to Twilight Zone. And the headlines this week in the Breaker.News. Newly acquired Grouse Mountain is but one of Northland Properties' pandemic-shut assets. Real estate agent pitching coronavirus test kits from Wuhan. While pandemic grips BC, health ministry bureaucrats play shark games. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news. The big deal feature on the Breaker.news podcast. This is the view from Bowen Island. It's a short ferry ride from West Vancouver in Howe Sound. It's an island of 20 square miles that is home to about 3,700 people. But the Bowen Islanders don't want you there right now. It's not even staycation time. It's stay home time because of the coronavirus pandemic here in British Columbia. But they will if you ask them politely. do a Zoom with you or go on Skype with you or FaceTime. And one of those Bone Islanders, Jim Mullen, he went on Skype with me. He's a veteran broadcaster who is the president of Football Canada. He's also the host of Crown Gridiron Nation on TSN, the sports network. I started by asking Jim, what is the mood on Bowen Island?
Well, at the best of time, gauging the mood of the residents of Bowen Island can be fraught with peril. But for the most part, when you're away from the cove, which is, you know, basically the downtown of Bowen Island, everything seems to be functioning normally. It's when you get into the cove that you realize that the restaurants are shut down. There's three businesses in the cove that are four businesses in the cove that are still up and going. There's the two pubs. There's the grocer. There's a pet food store. There's a liquor store. And there is one Korean-run Japanese restaurant that's up and going. So I guess that's more than a couple. The restaurants are all delivering or doing takeout. That's unique on Bowen Island because there's never been delivery for anything here. You can't order food on the phone. You can now. They are delivering for a $5 fee or a $10 fee, depending on the restaurant. In terms of getting food on the island, most of the islanders go, you know, on the 18-minute ferry ride, and they'll go over to the mainland and do their shopping. But many stay on the island, and there are options there. The Bowen Island pub that orders from the big Cisco truck is now taking orders from islanders. For instance, I picked up a box full of steaks, a giant roll of toilet paper, and a bag of rice today that was put aside for me on a table at 12:40 in the afternoon with my name on it. I sat outside. I waited about 12 feet away. Person sticks their head out. They go, "Your box is over there." You go, you grab the box. They put the tap down. I tapped my card. We kept our distance. And I took off with the food. The grocery store is a bit more of an adventure. You get the feeling that the staff is just protesting this whole process of having to move people in and out of the store, and it can be kind of difficult and social distancing free at times. So. So life on the islands changed a little bit, I'd say. And one great thing about it is I think at the end of the day, delivery from the restaurants is here to stay.
Now, if people see a map, they can see that Bowen Island itself is physically distanced from the mainland, physically distanced from Horseshoe Bay. But you've had to be a little bit physically distanced yourself. You've had a challenging month or so coming down with flu-like symptoms yourself. To walk us through a bit about that.
Yeah, back at around March 3rd, I attended a conference of about 70 people at the BC Lions training facility. I stayed at the Marriott downtown the next day and met with Randy Ambrosi, and that would be the fourth. Well, on the fifth, there was that dental convention that was in town, and about 6 days later, I came down with a rather severe headache for 2 days. And then another set of symptoms that led me to being sequestered in the guest room for about 8 days, whether it was body aches. There was a stretch where I slept 29 of 36 hours, some rattling around in the chest, anywhere from mild to moderate symptoms of something. I don't know what it was. I talked to two doctors. I talked to one doctor on the island via video chat. She came to the conclusion that it was influenza B, with a chest infection. And there's plenty of reasons to think that it was influenza B, because many of the symptoms that influenza B has, COVID-19 has, and it's been a bad influenza B season. However, I did then reach out to my GP, who's been assisting on the COVID task force on the North Shore. Had about half a dozen calls with him. He came to the conclusion that I probably had COVID. Now, the issue with that is I don't know, because I can't get a test. You know, the questions that were directed at me is, had I traveled internationally within the 14 days leading up to the 10th? No, I hadn't, but I'd been at the airport in that time. I had traveled back from Toronto from the SAGM of Football Canada, but that didn't count, right? It was only medical professionals. Then I pointed out where I was at the Marriott overnight and the proximity to the dental convention, and I was down at the bar for a couple hours. Luckily, there were probably a lot of dentists there. That didn't count either. So the issue that I have is, you know, is my immune system compromised, so I shouldn't go out? Do I have antibodies to COVID, so I can go out? Like, I really have no idea, because I never got tested. There's others on the island that had similar symptoms to me too. There's only one reported COVID case coming off the island. That was an individual who was in his late 30s who had to go to hospital, who also you know, worked at a bar in Vancouver. I haven't got the latest on him, but he's still up and around, and he got it rather more severely than I did. So a month later, I'm still dealing with crap in my chest and a cough, but you know, I'm well on my way to getting better. But it's still kind of frightening to know that without a test, you don't really know how you can function in society yet.
Finally, this week, they have decided to change the testing criteria to expand the field that can be tested. There may be many more people who are listening who may be in the same boat, wondering and hoping they don't have it. But now they may have the chance to finally get tested if their doctor approves. This health crisis that's gripped North America after gripping China, and it's also gripping Europe, has wide-ranging impacts throughout the economy, has wide-ranging impacts through sports. You're president of Football Canada. You're also host of the Crown Gridiron Nation on TSN. That's where a lot of Canadians would know you from. The CFL this week said that the season could possibly get underway in July. They had previously delayed training camps. How realistic do you think it is for the CFL to kick off in July?
Well, the information that I've received, and this was over a month ago, surrounding the pandemic and when we can get back to something that functions like normal, the government's projections at the time, and finally there was a story that came out, I think it was about 8 or 9 days ago about this, was the end of July. So let's assume it's the end of July that people can start congregating together or joining in groups of 50 or more. The CFL's challenges are numerous right now in this regard. For import players, mainly Americans, but also a number of internationals, if they want these guys on their roster, they would have to bring them into Canada, get clearance, then put them in quarantine for 14 days, pay for their hotel rooms, and pay for 3 square meals a day. You know, when you're dealing with, you know, 450 players, half of them are imports or global players, that starts to add up after a while, because very few of the import players stay in Canada during the winter. They go back to the States where the weather's a whole lot warmer. So that's a challenge in itself. There has been discussion about playing more Canadians in the Canadian Football League. The other issue is then having training camps, probably doing away with exhibition games. When does it kick off? Probably you're looking at Labor Day. So then there's a decision to make. Do they play a simple straight-out 8-game season over 9 weeks? Because of the odd number of teams, but if they play the 8-game season, everybody plays each other once, could be great entertainment, and a sprint to the finish and a sprint to the Grey Cup. They can accommodate that in on the schedule that they have with the Grey Cup in Regina. Or do they try to play a 14-game season or a 16-game season or even a 12-game season? There are sources that have said to me everything's on the table. Could we have a Grey Cup in January? Yeah, we could have a Grey Cup in January. You know, would it be in Regina? Probably not. Probably be moved to an indoor facility. You know, and of course, you know, the other challenge is twofold with your fan base. Now, a number of the season ticket holders across the league haven't asked for refunds yet. But are they comfortable going into a stadium shoulder to shoulder with strangers? And then, you know, in the case of energy dependent areas like Edmonton, Calgary, even Regina, you know, do those towns have the financial wherewithal if we hit unemployment rates of 20-25% for people to be spending money going to football games? That's where the challenge is. So, you know, places that used to draw 30,000 and 25,000 could easily be down into the numbers of drawing, you know, 8,000 to 15,000 overnight. The CFL's operating expenses for their roster are covered, but all the other expenses in terms of front office staff and executive and marketing and all those other things, that's made up for in ticket revenue. So they have a severe challenge on their hands. And the other thing that needs to be taken into consideration for the CFL is the second wave of the virus. You could start a season that could conceivably not have an end. And so, you know, I know that they've been working overtime at the CFL office on numerous scenarios. I hope they strike the chord with the right one if there's an available window to play football in this country.
Thank you very much for joining us, and best wishes to a quick recovery to you and anyone else on Bowen Island who is feeling under the weather.
Thanks very much, Bob. Thanks for having me.
That was Jim Mullen giving us the view from Bowen Island. Jim is host of Crown Gridiron Nation on TSN. He is also the president of Football Canada.
I did a volunteer stint, soup kitchen this morning. The poorest amongst us are being hurt by people who are hoarding. Grocery stores, surgical masks, sanitizers. So let me just say to those who are trying to exploit others, there must be a special place in hell. A special place in hell. A special place in hell for people like that. There must be a special place in hell.
That's from the Battle of Alberta. Jason Kenney sings Special Place in Hell by Anonymotif on YouTube.
I, Justin P.J. Trudeau.
No!
Sunny ways, my friends. Sunny ways.
People want to wear a mask. That is okay. It protects others more than it protects you, because it prevents you from breathing or speaking moistly on them. Oh, what a terrible image.
I, Justin P.J. Trudeau.
No!
Sunny ways, my friends. Sunny ways.
The Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to a person or group that is making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to all the priests, rabbis, and imams out there who are performing holy rituals for Easter, Passover, and Ramadan, respectively, via webcasting during the coronavirus pandemic. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send us an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting. Custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
I'm not a medical expert. These are the things we know. Keep 2 meters apart. What I have heard from medical experts. These are the things we know to prevent you from speaking moistly. Moistly.
That's from Justin Trudeau speaking moistly by Anani Motif on YouTube. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 12th, 2020. Did you know that on April 12th in 1980, Terry Fox began his marathon of hope to raise money to find a cure for cancer when he dipped his artificial leg in the Atlantic Ocean in St. John's, Newfoundland?
This afternoon at 2:45 in St. John's Harbor, Terry Fox dipped his foot into the waters of the Atlantic Ocean.
Mark September 20th on your calendar. The Marathon of Hope continues, the 40th Terry Fox Run. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.